Hello and welcome to the Thriving Podcast. I'm your host, Wayne Visser, and joining me today is Jed Emerson, who's Chief Impact Officer of LT Tiedemann Global and author of The Purpose of Capital. He's also one of the pioneers in the impact investing and blended value movements, and we have a fascinating conversation lined up for you. So let's get straight to it. Hi, Jed. Welcome to the Thriving Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Jed, we've known each other for a little bit now, and mainly that's been in the context of looking at value creation. And of course, you're associated with the concept of blended value. So I'm keen to find out what that is. But more generally, I think you're associated with impact investing. So maybe just give us a little insight into your career journey and how you got to where you are today and to be involved in these sorts of topics.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I started in community youth development and social work and reached a point in my late 20s where I felt like the traditional way of thinking about nonprofit, for-profit, public funding, all these issues really was not getting the job done. And so took a responsible exit from the organization I had founded, working with homeless youth in San Francisco, and began really an exploration that has taken me now 30 years of writing and exploring these ideas around value, capital, organizational form. And so I'm really part of, I think, a generation of us who kind of came up grappling with those issues. I spent 10, 11 years running a venture philanthropy fund in the US. And out of that work, one of the things we did was, I believe we convened the first formalized methodology around calculating a social return on investment. And as we started promoting that work, I began getting more and more invitations from for-profit, mission and purpose-driven investors asking to learn, how do you take that approach? How do you use that kind of a tool? Because at that time, people would say, well, we invest for social return, but they had no real frame around how to track that part of their performance. That then led to another 10-year period of my slotting in behind different firms, private equity, public equity, philanthropic, all of this idea around wanting to work with people who wanted to bridge the bifurcated value proposition, who were not interested in doing philanthropy or business, but wanted to do a both and kind of approach. And so that brought me to, 2010, when I literally kind of fell into family office work and spent the next 7 or 8 years working with families, because families don't come to the conversation with a lot of enthusiasm for trusts and corporate structure. They come with enthusiasm for what they as a family are trying to advance relative to their vision. Yeah. And so it's less an issue of, you know, what's the right form, then what are we trying to do? And I think that for me, I think come to this place, and I'm curious to get your perspective on this as well. It feels as if over the last 5 to 7 years, there's been a real shift of folks who are saying, all right, it's great that we have clever financial engineering. It's great that we have all these different organizational forms. But if we're not clear with regard to our understanding of the fundamental purpose of capital, the nature of value, then we're still going to miss the mark. And it yeah. feels as if there's been a lot of emphasis now on this conversation regarding purpose. I took some time off from my work in order to do the research and write my last book called The Purpose of Capital, which is available for free at the purposeofcapital.org website, because I really needed to drill back into the whole notion of how did we even get to this place where you could think of value as economic or social and environmental, as opposed to a more holistic or, as you've said, integrated approach to value. So I think that's kind of the journey and some of the ideas that I've explored over the last 35, 40 years.
Yeah, fascinating. And let's dig into a few of those in a bit more detail. I always find it interesting that people who start with a social embeddedness or an engagement with society, you know, wherever they end up, there's that need to integrate it, especially into business. I can see that's driven you as well. I want to just start by being clear there on a few of the terms that you've referred to. So if you're able to come up with some very short definitions or conceptions of a few things that we're talking about. So let's start with one maybe that is a bit more familiar to people. We've mentioned already impact investing. So what is that to you? What does that mean?
Well, I would use the Global Impact Investing Network's definition, which says something along the lines of impact investing is the deployment of capital in pursuit of financial return with measurable social and environmental impacts. And the only thing I would add to that would be to say that it is the deployment of capital in pursuit of various types of financial return and various forms of social and environmental impact. Because I think some people get so locked into this, we have to get a, quote, market rate financial return from our investment of impact capital, that they lose sight of what it is we're actually trying to use that capital to achieve, which really is the broader question around purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'd like us to sketch a little bit of how that movement has evolved. But before we do, let's get the definitions out the way. So the other one you mentioned was social return on investment. Maybe it sounds like it speaks for itself, but how do you understand that? How do you unpack that?
It would be the application of a formal methodology to calculate the economic value of social impacts that are created by virtue of the deployment of any form of capital, whether philanthropic, near market, or market rate.
Okay, interesting that also you refer to economic value, not just financial value. I think that's a key distinction, right? It's already broader. And then the other one you mentioned was venture philanthropy. What is that?
Yes, honestly, it's been around as a term for a long time, so I'm not sure what the current kind of definition that people use. I view it as, I mean, it came out of conversations I had with a financier who was frustrated with the fact that his options for supporting kind of positive work in the world was basically limited to charitable grants through a foundation. And so he challenged me to develop and explore with him ideas around how you would take business and financial acumen and tools and practices in order to advance social and community change. And so that's how I view it, is the application of business tools and practice to do something beyond business.
Yeah. So there's clearly an amount of money that is available and an expectation of some kind of social return, but also that there is a business logic in there somewhere, which is the venture part, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, and then blended value. What is that?
Blended value is the idea that the nature of value is whole and non-divisible, but made up of component parts of economic, social, and environmental worth.
Okay. All right. I mean, I think that's helpful already to get a bit of a landscape. The one I'm going to throw in, of course, is the one that's kind of sweeping the globe somewhat scarily, I would almost say, is ESG. Okay. So that's the new kid on the block, as if it's something new, and of course it's not. So maybe you could, you know, how do you understand ESG in the context of the financial sector now, especially, but also how do you link that to the movement that's been building for, you know, I would say at least since the 1970s, with the Pax World Fund, socially responsible investment or ethical investment. I think you take it back even further. So maybe you could just talk us through that.
Sure. Well, again, I think that for some people, this is a new conversation. For modern financial capitalism, it's not. If you think about the very first publicly traded company, the Dutch East India Group, 1604, they raised capital through a stock offering, financed an expedition, came back from the expedition very successfully, was very profitable. And then in the days after their return, it was discovered that when the group got to the Dutch East Indies, a lot of the prime trading locations had been taken already by the Spanish and the Portuguese and the French and the British. And so they engaged in warfare to basically go and steal. They engaged in piracy to take what they wanted and put that all together and brought it back. And when it was found that this was the case, you had one Mennonite shareholder who sold his shares to protest the fact that he felt that they violated the terms and conditions of their agreement, that he had bought a business strategy and a strategy of commerce, not a strategy of war. And in another case, you had another Mennonite who filed a lawsuit against the Board of Governors. And that lawsuit rolled out over the course of the next 10 years, was ultimately not successful. But the whole point in part was to really just raise these questions and considerations. So I think right at the beginning, you have this question of what is the purpose of the firm? What's the purpose of capital and investments? Fast forwarding, yes, you have the socially responsible investors of the 60s and 70s who screened things out. And I think all that, a lot of that culminated with the anti-apartheid movement and divestment as a practice. And which is a whole conversation we could have about the success of those strategies and how to think about them. But, we'll set that aside for now. In the kind of aftermath of that, people started thinking, well, wait a minute, if there are bad companies that we shouldn't be investing in, are there good companies that we should invest in? And you have the whole best in class movement or school of practice, finding, the best companies in diverse areas and investing in them. Then I think you had the ESG integration, which came out in the, I'm going to say, 80s, late 80s into the 90s, where folks said, actually what this is all about is understanding the degree to which environmental, social, and governance factors affect financial performance of the firm. Are those elements material to profitability? And for years, people had debated this. And so the ESG integration folks said, there are off-balance sheet risks that will affect financial performance. And if all you care about is financial return, and you're not looking beyond, the traditional financial metrics, you will underperform. And so that was the argument that was advanced. Then lastly, you had another set of investors who came to the table and said, well, I don't want to be investing in certain companies. I want to be investing in certain high-performing, kind of best-in-class companies. I want to have consideration for opening the aperture of risk and understanding how ESG factors affect publicly traded companies. And I want to draw as short a line as possible between the investment of my capital and the creation of community and ecosystem level change. And this work is what then evolved as impact investing, primarily in private markets. And I think that the closing point to this is that we need to take a total portfolio management approach and understand that all capital, all companies have impact. And the issue isn't, are you an impact investor? The issue is, what are the ways in which you're managing that impact with intentionality? And can you manage for net positive impact? And so this really should be the focus of the discussion across asset classes, across market rate, near market, and philanthropic capital deployment.
Yeah. So let's bring it right up to the present day. And we've seen a very strange and surprising explosion of ESG. I mean, it's taken me by surprise because it's not new, and yet suddenly it's on the radar, and suddenly you get big financial institutions getting behind it, setting up ESG funds, and even big players now substituting sustainability with ESG. You look at the big four accounting firms, they start to change the language of how they position their services as well. I mean, I'm interested in what happened, you know, to suddenly bring this explosion. But also, we know that there have been some criticisms. I mean, there's been greenwashing, essentially. And I'm of the view that that's probably good that that's been exposed, because we just raised the bar. But what's your view on the current furore around ESG?
Well, I think the first part is, you know, to the first part of your statement, is that we did see now a coming together, a phenomenal increase in the amount of offerings that were being put out in the market using the brand ESG. And I think what happened in my mind is that we basically, prior to, let's say, 2010, you had a lot of block parties, right? All of these different practices were evolving and were in action, but they were all in their own silo, their own block, if you will. And what I think happened starting in 2010 and moving forward is you started seeing more and more demand and interest, and the block parties kind of pulled off the block and went onto the avenues. And all of a sudden, you had a parade. You could look up and down the street and you could see different, you know, bands marching along with their banners and stuff. But all of a sudden, you had critical mass. And I think that, you know, that was part of it. That was caused in part by a growing demand on the part of investors for these types of products, and a growing recognition in the business community that, in fact, off-balance sheet risk was material to financial performance. I mean, that was really the piece. I remember it would have been probably 2005, let's call it, being at the World Economic Forum and hearing the head of Swiss Re talk about climate crisis and saying that, you know, he believed that it was true. And the reason he believed was because he's in insurance and he could see, like, you know, the exposure and what was happening in terms of the number of major storm events and the effects that it had. Mm-hmm. And his issue was that, you know, they were fine because they've been taking this into account relative to their underwriting practices. But unless everybody else, unless all the insurance companies embraced this idea, he would still lose money because he would have properties sitting next to properties that were not insured adequately. And that would bring down the overall long-term value of his investments. And so I think you had this moment where a lot of mainstream business people started thinking, why wouldn't we want to have a broader consideration of risk for our investments? And so that was one part. You then also had kind of the consumer demand piece. And so you had the opportunity to be able to take these, put them together, and start offering, you know, ETFs, mutual funds, you know, a host of different products within the public markets primarily that could use this brand of ESG as a way to sell to folks. And I think this is the trick. It's when we went from the investing side to the sales side, you then ended up with people misunderstanding. And I think people thought what they were buying were investment instruments that would help contribute to a better world, not investment instruments that were structured with consideration of how the changing climate crisis would affect the companies. Yeah. And that's what most of the analytic information is about. It's MSCI, Sustainalytics. I mean, all these folks, they're not tracking the contribution value to a positive world. They're tracking the degree to which environmental, social, and governance issues represent risks to companies and therefore to investors.
Yeah, yeah. That's such a crucial difference. And as you say, not well understood. I do wonder whether one of the turning points or tipping points was that strange thing that happened in 2019 around purpose, you know, where you had Larry Fink of BlackRock, who'd been writing letters to CEOs, but suddenly really stepping up and saying that unless you change your purpose to be about stakeholders and not just shareholders, you know, you're going to miss the mark and we may consider disinvesting. and more specifically then his subsequent letters really around climate risk. But that was combined with a business roundtable statement on purpose of the corporation, again, saying it's about stakeholders. As I said to Ed Freeman, who we had on here as well, you know, only like, what was it, 25 years late after stakeholder theory, but still came around. And then World Economic Forum as well with the Davos Manifesto, same year, all about changing the purpose. Now, we can be cynical about that and say, wow, these companies haven't really changed their purpose. It's still business as usual. But somehow I think it's symbolic of a shift in values that is happening, and we start to see reflected in the markets as well.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true. You have a generational shift, which is part of it. You have more kind of younger people coming up in these firms that are asking a different set of questions about corporate purpose and meaning. And that kind of trickles up. And at the same time, the trickle down is you do have, you know, the Larry Finks of the world going to conferences, hearing about what's happening in the broader world and realizing these things really are material to the health and wellness of my company and by extension, our investments. And so I think that's where you start getting that intersection between these various camps and communities.
Yeah. Now, I want to come to some examples of good practice, because I think that's essential. Can we make this real for people? Are there particular companies you think are doing better or more, or particular projects or initiatives or even movements that we really should be supporting and applauding and taking note of? Do any come to mind for you?
Well, I mean, of course, the classic that everybody points to, especially more recently, is Patagonia, as a company that privately held and recently was set up now in a series of trusts that are philanthropic vehicles, so that they're separating really ownership from governance, if you will, and making it really baking impact into the mission of the firm at a whole different level. So that's pretty exciting to see. But also, you know, to the previous comments, I mean, not altogether new. In Denmark, you have a long tradition of public companies being owned by foundations, you know, Carlsberg, Novo Norsk, I'm not even sure what other ones there are, Maersk. These are all major, you know, companies that have controlling interest on the basis of foundations and philanthropy. Whereas in the U.S., there's a different structural form that we're allowed to do here, but it's not the same thing quite yet.
Yeah. Yeah, those are interesting examples. And yeah, Patagonia has always been inspiring, but now it takes it to another level. But maybe to take now a critical perspective, I remember speaking to Charles Handy. I don't know if that's a familiar name to you, but
yeah, you bet.
Management guru for many years, and sure. I'm a great fan. In fact, he had this wonderful book called The Hungry Spirit, which was all about purpose in organizations. But when I asked him about the socially responsible investment movement as it was then, and also the sort of employee share ownership movement, he was quite hesitant, because he said the last thing we want to do is turn everybody into shareholders, because then they behave like shareholders, which is greedy and selfish and short-term. So I'm wondering if what's happening now in the investment world, you know, is more of that. Are we playing into the hands of those that seem to have created the problem in the first place by trying to financialize everything or even speak the language, which is what ESG is trying to do, of the financial sector? Or do you see it differently?
My feeling, and I think there's room for a lot of opinions on this because it's part of what makes for a rich community of practice. But I've come to a place where I feel as if we are serious about climate crisis and the literally the existential threat represented by climate crisis, if we take seriously the idea that we have 10 years, you know, maybe 20, depending on how you count. But unless we turn the ship within the next 1 to 2 decades, we will end up in a world that will have slaughtered more animals, destroyed more human communities. You know, just all this stuff will be unleashed. If all that is true, I don't know that we have time to be as precious as we have been in the past. I think we need to come in and own the vehicles that we can direct. And there is a whole argument to be made around what Audre Lorde said was, you can't deconstruct the master's house with the master's tools. At the same time, just as that is true, if I have 10 years, I don't know that I can wait for the social and economic revolution to bring in the new order, if you will. Yeah. And so in my personal case, I mean, I decided to join what I think of as kind of a Goldilocks firm, that it, you know, it's not a BlackRock or, you know, a major multi-trillion dollar entity, but it's also not a small boutique, and play a part in creating some economic tools and advancing some solutions, working with ultra high net worth families and foundations to deploy capital in new and better ways that really are advancing integrated value and returns that has, again, different levels of financial performance together with social and environmental impacts that are positive. And I think that we need to be focused as a laser on this idea that we need solutions and we need change and we need to transition. And if all we do is stop and try to shut down the current economic order, we will have disorder, we will have collapse, as we rightly should, for those systems. But we have to transition, and we have to create a transition economy. And that almost by definition means we're going to have to figure out some way to take parts of the current structure that do work and move those forward, just as we're leaving the parts that don't behind.
Yeah. Yeah, which is what you're doing now, is changing the system from within. And that's harder. And it really is about integration and mainstreaming, not being boutique where you can be pure and lovely, but, you know, just not have so much impact. Just quickly, because we're coming to the end, but in light of what you were saying about climate risk, I mean, what came out of Glasgow, and by the time this airs, we will also have had the COP27, but the Glasgow Financial Alliance, which I think is now the Global Financial Alliance, $130 trillion, that's a big deal, right? I mean, that really is a kind of massive shift. It's not that all of those banks are clean and pure, but they're committing to dedicate their capital to fund this transition, right?
Yes, they are. And, you know, as you kind of inferred, we also in the last few months have seen more and more of those institutions suddenly realize what they actually had committed to and beginning to rethink that. And I think this is the process. It shouldn't surprise us. And we need to really understand that as we start to dial back and redirect the forces of modern financial capitalism, there are phenomenal embedded interests that will work against everything that we are trying to promote. And so it's no surprise. And so maybe that $300 trillion goes down to like $150 trillion. And that's still a lot of money to drive change in this time. So I think that's, we need to not be like, oh, it's so cynical that they did this. It's like, okay, they got on board. They didn't fully understand the implications of what's involved. And so now our job is to stay engaged and to continue to engage and promote and advance the issues and practices that we care about as well.
Yeah. Well, last question, because I know you're a passionate reader as well, which gives me hope, because I love to hear that people still read books as well as write them. So apart from your own books, and especially your latest book, The Purpose of Capital, if you were to recommend just one that has inspired you or you think gives some really interesting insight right now,
sure.
Any idea what that would be?
I think One of the concepts that I do talk about in The Purpose of Capital is the idea that impact is often framed as something we do to other people. How many jobs do we create? How much acreage do we set aside? When in fact, the greater power of impact is in the notion of mutual impact and the fact that we can become as transformed by the process of impact investing as those that we seek to benefit. And recently, Sarah Horowitz, who's a longtime activist and had done a cooperative health insurance company, has been very successful in a lot of calls, has published a book called Mutualism, Building the Next Economy from the Ground Up. And I think that this book really has some really excellent ideas and historical context for a lot of the conversations that we're having. And I think ultimately, for us to be successful, we have to understand that we are fundamentally connected, we are fundamentally a whole system that's in operation, in motion, and that we are mutually connected, one with the other, and that that is both our best hope in terms of the reality for change and, in some ways, the biggest challenge, because of the fact that we are connected and we have to live our lives that way when we have not done so in the past.
Yeah. Wonderful. I mean, that is, of course, the essence of thriving as well, is interconnectedness. And I'm really glad to discover this book as well. I wasn't aware of it. So we'll put it in the show notes. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jed, and sharing some of your experience and your thoughts. All the best with the new role, and we'll stay in touch.
That'd be great. It's my pleasure. Thank you, Wayne.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. When I was thinking about which poem to share with you this week, I got thinking that a lot of Jed's work has been about shifting the landscape, particularly the investment landscape, and recognizing that these movements go through evolutions. And he's one of the people that I really admire for cutting through all of the jargon and all of the competing silos, and really just getting stuck in and looking to the essence of what is it that is changing, and how can we use the levers of the system itself to bring about the changes that we're trying to make. And so the poem I'm going to share with you now is a recent one, which is quite lighthearted, but it is all about action and movement. It's a poem called I Like to Move It. Nothing comes to those who stand still, for life is a dance of changes, a puzzle that rearranges, shaped by the power of our will. It's not that we are in control, or that we reach our every dream. Still, we must paddle in the stream if we're to move towards our goal. That means we have to take a chance and trust that we can make it work. There is no time to slack or shirk or give our fears a second glance. This is true, though I can't prove it. Stand still long enough and you're dead. For as a wise lemur once said, I like to move it, move it. Thank you for joining me this time, and I hope you'll tune in next time when I'm absolutely delighted to be welcoming Sarah Langford, who describes herself as a writer, barrister, and farmer. She is, in fact, the author of the fantastic book Rooted, and we will be getting into that, how regenerative farming can change the world. I'll see you then. In the meantime, have a great and thriving week.